Verse 31. And when Israel saw the wondrous power which the Lord had wielded against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord. They had faith in the Lord and his servant Moses. Although this verse has become famous in Jewish liturgy and tradition, depending on how one translates the Hebrew word Vayaminu, the word can be viewed as reflecting either positively or negatively on the Israelites. The normal translation of Vayaminu is believed in. And if the verse means they believed in the Lord, as believe in is usually understood, it would reflect negatively on the Israelites. It would imply that, despite all the miracles they already witnessed, they didn't believe that God existed until the splitting of the sea and the drowning of the Egyptians. And it would imply they also came to believe in Moses as a godlike figure. Those problems are resolved, however, if the Hebrew word Vayaminu is interpreted as they trusted in, or as it is rendered here, had faith in. In Hebrew, as in English, when we say to someone, I believe in you, what we are really saying is, I trust you, not I believe you exist. Thus, the drowning of the Egyptians did not convince the Israelites to believe in God's existence, but to trust in God, that he fulfills his promises. And just as the people learned to trust in God, they also learned to trust in Moses as a reliable servant of God. Regarding the phrase servant of God, it is worth noting again that the Hebrew word for servant is the same word for slave, eved. In this verse, it is obvious eved means servant. Moses was not the slave of God. But in other places in the Torah, whether eved means slave or servant is not always clear, which complicates some of the discussion about slavery in the Torah. Chapter 15. The following song, verses 1 through 19, is written in beautiful Hebrew poetry, which cannot be fully captured in translation. In the widely viewed English language animated film about the Exodus, The Prince of Egypt, this is the one section from the Bible sung in Hebrew. Essay. Is it moral to celebrate the death of evildoers? Verse 1. Then Moses and the Israelites sang this song to the Lord. According to a well-known passage in the Talmud, the angels too broke out in song when the Egyptians were drowning in the sea. But the Talmud states God rebuked them. My creatures, the Egyptians are drowning, and you sing songs? This Talmudic passage is often cited by Jews who believe it is wrong for people to rejoice at the fall of an enemy, no matter how evil. But the story does not support that view. God does not rebuke Moses and the Israelites, he only rebukes the angels. Why? Because God does not hold people to the same standards as he does angels. When people see their or even others' would-be murderers drowning, it is both natural and moral to express relief followed by joy. Furthermore, the angels' lives were not in danger. The Israelites were. This is a fascinating passage fraught with moral questions. One doesn't have to take the Talmudic passage literally to appreciate its moral insight and its moral difficulty. The morality of the passage is quite admirable. That ancient Jews would describe God as rebuking angels for celebrating the demise of those seeking to kill and enslave Jews is a remarkable moral achievement. Nevertheless, there are moral grounds for challenging the passage. Was it really wrong for the angels to rejoice? One can understand why God might not be depicted as having rejoiced. Every human being is his child, and remains so even when doing evil. But angels are not parents of all mankind. Why shouldn't they rejoice over the fact the Israelites, or any other innocents, were spared death and slavery? Why would that be wrong? Furthermore, if we are to be honest, the Talmudic passage does imply criticism of the Israelites. If humans are supposed to aspire to be godlike, they are surely supposed to aspire to be angel-like. And if the angels were wrong in rejoicing, then on some level so were the Israelites. It is also critical to note the angels' celebration is not necessarily about a victory for Jews, but a victory for morality. People intent on doing evil were prevented from doing so, thereby sparing the innocent suffering and death. That's a moral achievement and should therefore be rejoiced over. Yes, one can always acknowledge the death of those doing evil is ultimately a human tragedy, but it is infinitely less tragic than the alternative. Similarly, when people pose the question as, should one celebrate the fall of one's enemy, they are not posing a moral question. The issue is not whether one should celebrate the fall of one's enemy. It is whether one should celebrate the fall of evil people and the consequent saving of the innocent. When I watch World War II films and see Nazi soldiers killed, I am mindful of the fact those soldiers were drafted and they left behind grieving mothers, fathers, girlfriends, wives, and children. But I am happy they were killed, because either the Nazi soldier or the soldier of a decent country was going to die. And the death of every Nazi soldier hastened the end of the Nazi regime and the closing of the Nazis' death and concentration camps. Would it be more noble not to be happy about all those facts? If one should not be happy the soldier fighting against the Nazi regime was spared and the life of the Nazi regime was shortened, what should one feel? Some might say the proper response is happiness over the sparing of the Allied soldiers and the weakening of the Nazi regime, but not over the death of Nazi soldiers. But that avoids confronting the moral reality that the only way to have saved the lives of Allied soldiers and hasten the end of the Nazi regime was to kill Nazi soldiers. If no Nazi soldiers were killed, the Nazis would never have surrendered. Whatever one concludes about the morality of celebrating the downfall of evil, this Talmudic story achieves two important purposes. It reminds us that even one's enemies, and even those who do evil, are still human beings created in God's image. And it forces us to ask moral questions. Verse 1 continued. They said, I will sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. Horse and driver he has hurled into the sea. This entire song is about God. Moses plays no active role, and there is no mention of the angel of death, the cloud, or the darkness. It is God alone who is celebrated here. Sarna. The desire to keep attention focused on God and not on a human being, great as Moses was, likewise characterizes the Passover Seder book, the Haggadah, in which Moses' name is mentioned only once and only in passing. Verse 2. The Lord is my strength and might. He is become my deliverance. This is my God, and I will enshrine him, the God of my father, and I will exalt him. To be a God of love, God must also be a God of war. Verse 3. The Lord, the warrior. The Hebrew literally says, the Lord is a man of war. This strikes those moderns for whom war is by definition immoral as a morally primitive way of describing God. Many people are much more comfortable saying God is love, but sometimes the only way to stop evil and increase love is through war. God must therefore be both love and warrior. In this case, when the Israelites are fleeing heavily armed professional troops, God acts as a warrior on their behalf. That was the only thing a God of love could do. Verse 3 continued, Lord is his name. Verse 4, Pharaoh's chariots and his army he has cast into the sea, and the pick of his officers are drowned in the sea of reeds. Verse 5, the deeps covered them. They went down into the depths like a stone. Verse 6, your right hand, O Lord, glorious in power, your right hand, O Lord, shatters the foe. Verse 7, in your great triumph you break your opponents. You send forth your fury. It consumes them like straw. Verse 8, at the blast of your nostrils the waters piled up. The floods stood straight like a wall. The deeps froze in the heart of the sea. Verse 9, the foe said, I will pursue, I will overtake, I will divide the spoil. My desire shall have its fill of them. I will bear my sword, my hand shall subdue them. Verse 10, you made your wind blow, the sea covered them. They sank like lead in the majestic waters. Verse 11, who is like you, O Lord, among the gods? This verse, one of the most famous lines in Jewish liturgy, does not imply God is one among many gods. Rather, it means none of the false gods who are worshipped by pagan nations can compare to the one true God. Verse 11 continued, "Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in splendor, working wonders?" Verse 12, "You put out your right hand, the earth swallowed them." Verse 13, "In your love you lead the people you redeemed. In your strength you guide them to your holy abode." Verse 14, "The peoples hear, they tremble. Agony grips the dwellers in Philistia." Philistia refers to the Philistines. When, many centuries later, the Romans conquered Judea, they sought to obliterate all memory of it as a Jewish nation and renamed it Palestine after the ancient Philistines. Verse 15. "Now are the clans of Edom dismayed. The tribes of Moab, trembling grips them. All the dwellers in Canaan are aghast." Verse 16. "Terror and dread descend upon them. Through the might of your arm they are still as stone. Till your people cross over, O Lord, till your people cross whom you have ransomed." Verse 17. "You will bring them and plant them in your own mountain, the place you made to dwell in, O Lord. The sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands established." Verse 18. "The Lord will reign forever and ever." Verse 19. "For the horses of Pharaoh with his chariots and horsemen went into the sea, and the Lord turned back on them the waters of the sea. But the Israelites marched on dry ground in the midst of the sea." Verse 20. "Then Miriam the prophetess, Aaron's sister, took a timbrel in her hand." This is the first time Moses' sister is described as a prophetess. Curiously, she is only identified as Aaron's sister, not as Moses' as well, which is among the highest accolades a person can receive in the Hebrew Bible. A prophet or prophetess is a spokesperson for God. Miriam is the only woman designated as such in the Torah, though later biblical books speak of other women prophets, such as Deborah, Judges chapter 4, verse 4, Huldah, 2 Kings chapter 22, verse 14, and Noadiah, Nehemiah chapter 6, verse 14. Also, the prophet Isaiah writes that his wife was a prophetess, Isaiah chapter 8, verse 3. Genesis records the matriarch Rebekah receiving a direct revelation from God, Genesis chapter 25, verses 22 through 23. Verse 20 continued, "And all the women went out after her in dance with timbrels." Rashi comments that the women of that generation had such great faith in God, they took timbrels with them when they left Egypt, confident they would use them to celebrate God's miracles on the Israelites' behalf. Verse 21, "And Miriam chanted for them, 'Sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. Horse and driver he has hurled into the sea.'" Verse 22, "Then Moses caused Israel to set out from the Sea of Reeds. They went on into the wilderness of Shur." The Israelites' first of four crises in the desert. Verse 22 continued, "They traveled 3 days in the wilderness and found no water." The lack of drinking water described in verses 22 through 26 is the first in a series of four crises that befall the Jewish people on their way to Mount Sinai. Each of these crises, the second involved a lack of food, the third a lack of water again, and the fourth an attack by a desert tribe, illustrated both the precarious nature of Israel's survival and God's providential care. Despite all that has been done on their behalf, during three of these crises, the Israelites complain bitterly to Moses and to God. Although God does not get angry with the people in any of these situations, the Torah's account is an implied critique of the people's repeated ingratitude and lack of faith. No matter what God does for the Israelites, their implicit or explicit response is, "What have you done for me lately?" It took the Israelites a mere 3 days to lose sight of all the miracles God performed and to start complaining. Most people, like the Israelites, complain far more often than they express gratitude. People frequently register a complaint with a manufacturer or service provider, but they rarely write a note of thanks for a job well done. We would all do well to consider writing a thank you note each time we write a letter of complaint. Similarly, and more importantly, too many people criticize their spouses more often than they compliment them. That is the road to an unhappy marriage. Verse 23. They came to Marah, but they could not drink the water of Marah because it was bitter. That is why it was named Marah. The Hebrew word Marah means bitter. Jews eat a bitter herb at the Passover Seder to identify with the suffering of the slaves. It is called Maror. Verse 24. And the people grumbled against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" Verse 25. So he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a piece of wood. He threw it into the water, and the water became sweet. While it has been noted that this can be explained as a natural phenomenon in which porous wood filters out impurities in the water and renders it drinkable, what renders this a miracle is that a piece of wood can sweeten the water for so large a number of people. Verse 25 continued, "There he made for them a statute and a law, and there he put it to the test." Verse 26. He said, "If you will heed the Lord your God diligently, doing what is upright in his sight, giving ear to his commandments and keeping all his laws, then I will not bring upon you any of the diseases that I brought upon the Egyptians, for I, the Lord, am your healer." This verse does not say that if the Israelites observe all of God's laws, they will never suffer any disease. It only says God will not bring upon them any of the diseases he brought upon the Egyptians. The Israelites could easily have thought, given all God did on their behalf, they would be treated by God in a special way, that God would not apply the same standards to them as to all other nations. Ironically, if that is what they thought, they were right. God did not judge them by the standards by which he judged other nations. He judged them by a higher standard. Essay: God doesn't protect religious people from illness. Understanding this verse properly, with its assertion that if Jews observe God's laws, he will not inflict on them the diseases he inflicted on Egypt, is important for another reason. There are many religious people who believe if they act or believe in accordance with God's will, God should and will protect them from calamities, such as bad health and early death. At a speech in an Orthodox Jewish synagogue in London, I was asked how I explained that observant Jews, Jews who strictly observe the laws of Shabbat and Kashrut, for example, get struck with cancer or a heart attack at an early age. I was taken aback by the question, as I never associated keeping God's commandments with protection from illness. So I asked those present to raise their hands if they believed God protected the observant from disease. About half the audience raised their hands. Likewise, there are Christians who believe that with enough faith, one will not get seriously ill. There are many problems with that belief. First, it is obviously not true. Many pious people have been afflicted with disease, and many non-religious and evil people have lived long and healthy lives. It should be obvious to anyone there is simply no correlation between religiosity and being protected from illness. There are measurable health benefits to leading the purposeful, family-centered, and community-centered life healthy religious practices provide, but that is another matter. How could there be such a correlation? As Harold Kushner has observed, does the belief God protects the righteous mean a good religious person can go out in freezing weather without a coat and never get sick? Second, if God really did protect religious people from all illness, why would any rational person not be religious? Moreover, faith would no longer be faith. It wouldn't take any faith to believe in God and to lead a religious life. It would be a completely empirically based decision. Observe X and you will never get cancer. Believe Y and you will never get heart disease. That's not faith. It's a healthcare decision. Third, the belief God protects those with proper observance or faith from all disease must ultimately lead to an unsympathetic, even judgmental response to people who get sick. If only they were more observant, or if only they had a deeper faith, they wouldn't have gotten cancer or had that heart attack. The victim of cancer or a heart attack is then doubly victimized. So, are there rewards for being a good person, or specifically for being a faithful religious person? Yes, there are, and they fall into two categories: this world rewards and rewards in the afterlife. Regarding the afterlife, any belief in a just God must mean the good are rewarded and the evil are punished. It is axiomatic that if there is a God, and if that God is just, there is ultimate justice. And since justice rarely exists in this world, just think of young children murdered in terrorist attacks or mistreated by abusive parents, ultimate justice must take place in the next world. A Talmudic passage teaches, there is no reward for the commandments, mitzvot, in this world, meaning God does not reward the faithful in this world. That does not mean there aren't rewards for leading a religious life in this world. There certainly are. But they differ from rewards in the next world in that they are not dispensed by God. They are intrinsic to leading a good religious life. The reward for keeping God's laws is in the keeping of the laws. Again, as the Talmud puts it, the reward for observing a commandment is the observing of the commandment. Schar mitzvah mitzvah. In other words, performing that mitzvah, commandment, is the reward. The clearest example is the Shabbat. Taking one day every week off from work, away from business and commerce, and spending it with friends, family, and community is so beneficial to one's life that asking to be rewarded further is asking too much. It would be like asking for a reward for driving sober. The reward of driving without drinking is usually getting to one's destination alive and well. In fact, if one wants additional divine rewards for keeping one, some, or all of God's laws, it can only mean that individual finds little or nothing intrinsically rewarding in the keeping of the laws. Verse 27. And they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees, and they encamped there beside the water. Chapter 16. Verse 1. Setting out from Elim, the whole Israelite community came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their departure from the land of Egypt. Miracles bring people to faith in God for a very short time. Verse 2. In the wilderness, the whole Israelite community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. By supplying an exact date, the Torah is reminding us it was only a little over a month since the Israelites sang a song of gratitude at their triumph over the Egyptians. Yet, as we will now see, they are already complaining that they would rather be back in Egypt. The ingratitude of the Israelites so soon after the miracles they witnessed is not only a statement about the Israelites. More importantly, it demonstrates a truism that is by no means self-evident. Despite what almost all of us may think, miracles do not necessarily lead to faith. In this regard, the witty American filmmaker Woody Allen was wrong when he insisted he would come to believe in God if only God would give me a clear sign, like making a large deposit in my name in a Swiss bank. He was wrong because if a miracle is what gives people faith, such faith won't last long. Shortly after a miracle, people begin to demand another miracle. Let's imagine a large deposit was made in Woody Allen's name in a Swiss bank account. For how long would he continue to believe in God? Until the money was depleted? Until he contracted a severe illness and demanded a miraculous cure? Until he came to believe some anonymous human donor made the deposit? Besides, there are miracles surrounding us every single day of our lives. Why isn't the universe a miracle? Why isn't biological life a miracle? Intelligent life, love, music, the workings of the cell. When you think about it, any of these things dwarf one split C in terms of the miraculous. A human being is created from one sperm cell entering an egg. Why isn't that miraculous? Because it happens so frequently? So what? Why isn't that a miracle too? Indeed, the most rational explanation for the existence of anything is that it is a miracle. Why is everything came about on its own, by chance, more rational than everything is a miracle, meaning divine intervention made the otherwise improbable, if not impossible, happen? Do people prefer liberty or to be taken care of? Verse 3. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots, when we ate our fill of bread." The Israelites drew an exaggerated, idealized picture of the past. They longed to return to Egypt, not because the food was really as plentiful as they claim, but because as slaves they did not have to provide for themselves. It is a myth people yearn most for freedom. Some people, thank God, do, but many, if not most people, prefer to be taken care of, even at the price of a loss of freedoms, rather than have to take care of themselves. That is why people almost everywhere in the world prefer a big state to a limited one, even though, by definition, the bigger the state, the less the individual's freedom. That is why the American experiment in limited government was unique in world history, and therefore produced the freest country in world history. It is not coincidental it was founded by people who revere the Hebrew Bible. As noted, the words on the Liberty Bell, the symbol of the American Revolution, are from the Torah, and they are about liberty. Leviticus chapter 25, verse 10. Verse 3 continued, "For you have brought us out into this wilderness to starve this whole congregation to death." Complainers are masters of exaggeration. Did they really believe God's and Moses' motivation in confronting Pharaoh and bringing the 10 plagues down upon Egypt was to free the Israelites and then starve them to death? Verse 4, "And the Lord said to Moses, 'I will rain down bread for you from the sky, and the people shall go out and gather each day that day's portion.'" Although it is not yet referred to as such, this is the beginning of the manna God provides the Israelites throughout their 40 years of wandering in the desert. Verse 4 continued, "That I may thus test them, to see whether they will follow my instructions or not." Most people understand this to mean God is testing the people's faith to see if they will trust God to provide them with enough food to eat every day. But the opposite may also be true. God may be testing the people's faith by giving them food every day to see if they will still believe in Him even when they are well fed. We are tested in our faith regardless of our material circumstances. If we are poor, we have to be able to affirm God in spite of our privation. If we are rich, we have to keep God in our lives even though we might be tempted to think we don't really need Him. Both the poor and the rich have reasons to doubt and reasons to believe. Belief in God, like just about everything else in life, is a choice. Verse 5, "But on the 6th day, when they apportion what they have brought in, it shall prove to be double the amount they gather each day." The Israelites will receive a double portion of manna on Friday, so they do not have to gather it on Shabbat day. This double portion is the origin of the Jewish tradition of serving 2 Shabbat breads, chalot, at Shabbat meals. Verse 6, "So Moses and Aaron said to all the Israelites, 'By evening you shall know it was the Lord who brought you out from the land of Egypt.'" This is quite a statement. Are Moses and Aaron really saying that only after receiving manna, as opposed to witnessing the 10 plagues, the splitting of the sea, and the drowning of the Egyptian army, the Israelites will know it was the Lord who brought you out from the land of Egypt? This statement underscores yet again that miracles sustain faith for only a brief period. Verse 7, "And in the morning you shall behold the presence of the Lord, because He has heard your grumblings against the Lord. For who are we that you should grumble against us?" Verse 8, "Since it is the Lord," Moses continued, "who will give you flesh to eat in the evening and bread in the morning to the full, because the Lord has heard the grumblings you utter against Him, what is our part? Your grumbling is not against us, but against the Lord." Moses here is not merely absolving Aaron and himself from blame. He is reminding the Israelites that neither he nor Aaron is the source of miracles. God alone is. In the book of Numbers, Moses does seem to inadvertently take credit for the miracle of extracting water from a rock, and for that reason, he is not allowed to enter the promised land. See the commentary on Numbers, chapter 20, verse 20. Verse 9. "Then Moses said to Aaron, 'Say to the whole Israelite community, advance toward the Lord, for He has heard your grumbling.'" Verse 10. "And as Aaron spoke to the whole Israelite community, they turned toward the wilderness, and there in a cloud appeared the presence of the Lord. Verse 11. The Lord spoke to Moses. Verse 12. I have heard the grumbling of the Israelites. Speak to them, and say, By evening you shall eat flesh, and in the morning you shall have your fill of bread, and you shall know that I, the Lord, am your God. Verse 13. In the evening, quail appeared and covered the camp. In the morning there was a fall of dew about the camp. Verse 14. When the fall of dew lifted, there, over the surface of the wilderness, lay a fine and flaky substance, as fine as frost on the ground. Verse 15. When the Israelites saw it, they said to one another, What is it? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, That is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. Verse 16. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather as much of it as each of you requires to eat, an omer to a person for as many of you as there are. Each of you shall fetch for those in his tent. Verse 17. The Israelites did so, some gathering much, some little. Verse 18. But when they measured it by the omer, he who had gathered much had no excess, and he who had gathered little had no deficiency. They had gathered as much as they needed to eat. An omer is approximately 3.5 pounds, or 1.6 kilograms. The people were permitted to gather this amount of manna per day. No matter how much they gathered, it would always miraculously amount to exactly the measure needed to feed each of them. If this miracle did not take place, Israelites would likely compete and even fight with one another to gather more manna for themselves. Verse 19. And Moses said to them, Let no one leave any of it over until morning. God wanted the people to learn they could rely on him to provide food for the next day. Verse 20. But they paid no attention to Moses. Some of them left some of it until morning, and it became infested with maggots and stank. The Torah reports that right after the drowning of the Egyptians, the people believed, that is, trusted, in the Lord and Moses, his servant. Exodus chapter 14, verse 31. Now, a month later, they disregard Moses' instructions out of a lack of faith in him. The point is made again and again. A faith based on miracles will quickly fade, dependent on the next miracle. Such an attitude cannot even be called faith. Verse 20 continued, And Moses was angry with them. Moses will become angry with his people often in the Torah, usually appropriately, sometimes not. It is another example of the Torah showing the flaws of either its greatest hero or of the Jews, and an important argument for believing in the veracity of the Torah. Verse 21. So they gathered it every morning, each as much as he needed to eat, for when the sun grew hot, it would melt. Verse 22. On the sixth day they gathered double the amount of food, two omers for each, and when all the chieftains of the community came and told Moses, Verse 23, he said to them, This is what the Lord meant. Tomorrow is a day of rest, a holy Sabbath of the Lord. Bake what you would bake and boil what you would boil, and all that is left put aside to be kept until morning. Verse 24, so they put it aside until morning as Moses had ordered, and it did not turn foul, and there were no maggots in it. Verse 25, then Moses said, Eat it today, for today is a Sabbath of the Lord. You will not find it today on the plain. Here is the establishment of the Shabbat, Sabbath, by God, a holy day each week, set apart from the other days for rest and spiritual rejuvenation. God had not yet given the Ten Commandments, in which he will command the Israelites to observe the Shabbat. God's provision of manna for Shabbat on the day before, the only day of the week on which the excess food provision they gathered wouldn't spoil, caused the Israelites to instantly regard the Shabbat as a day distinct from other days of the week. Verse 26. 6 days you shall gather it. On the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will be none. One of the miraculous aspects of the manna is it does not conform to the natural order. Unlike the sun, for example, which rises every morning, the manna falls only 6 days out of seven. Verse 27. Yet some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather, but they found nothing. Verse 28. And the Lord said to Moses, How long will you men refuse to obey my commandments and my teachings? The Torah has specified very few commandments and teachings at this point. Examples would include circumcision, Genesis chapter 17, verses 12 through 14, Passover and its rituals, Exodus chapter 12, verse 14 and verses 17 through 20, and the Sabbath in the preceding verses. But the larger point here is, despite all God has done for them in the last few months, providing for them and saving them with one miracle after another, they still didn't follow God's ways. Verse 29. Mark that the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore he gives you 2 days' food on the sixth day. Let everyone remain where he is. Let no one leave his place on the seventh day. By emphasizing God is giving you 2 days' food on the sixth day, this was likely and specifically a prohibition on the Israelites going out and seeking manna on the Shabbat. Verse 30. So the people remained inactive on the seventh day. Finally, the people obey God's commandment. Verse 31. The house of Israel named it manna. It was like coriander seed, white, and it tasted like wafers and honey. This description of the manna is included in the Torah for the sake of later generations of readers who would not have any idea what manna was or how it tasted. Verse 32. Moses said, "This is what the Lord has commanded. Let one omer of it be kept throughout the ages, in order that they may see the bread that I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out from the land of Egypt." Verse 33. And Moses said to Aaron, "Take a jar, put one omer of manna in it, and place it before the Lord to be kept throughout the ages." Again, memory is the key to gratitude. The Jews are to preserve an omer of manna as a reminder of the manna, one of God's early acts of kindness to them. Verse 34. As the Lord had commanded Moses, Aaron placed it before the pact to be kept. As has been noted, the Torah is not always written in chronological order, and this is another example. The pact refers to the ark in which the Ten Commandments were kept, yet the giving of the Ten Commandments isn't described until chapter 20. Verse 35. And the Israelites ate manna 40 years until they came to a settled land. They ate the manna until they came to the border of the land of Canaan. For 40 years, God nursed the Israelite nation like a mother would an infant, providing the Israelites food and water, hoping they would eventually mature as a people. 40 years is a long weaning period, but it was a major challenge to convert the slaves of Pharaoh, or their children, or any other people then or later, into ethical monotheists. The daily portion of manna continued until after the death of Moses, and only stopped during the time of Moses' successor, Joshua. Joshua chapter 5, verse 12. Verse 36. The omer is a tenth of an ephah. An ephah equals about 35 liters. Chapter 17, verse 1. From the wilderness of Sin, the whole Israelite community continued by stages as the Lord would command. They encamped at Rephidim, and there was no water for the people to drink. This is the third of four crises to befall the Israelites between their departure from Egypt and arrival at Sinai. The Israelites do not seem to differentiate between God and Moses. Verse 2. The people quarreled with Moses. "Give us water to drink," they said. And Moses replied to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you try the Lord?" The Israelites do not seem to differentiate between God and Moses. They demand that Moses, not God, provide them with water. This is understandable given how visible Moses was as opposed to the invisible God, given the miracles God performed through him, and given their previous life in a society in which the Pharaoh was a man-god. In his responses, Moses made the differentiation clear and argued against their testing a demonstrably trustworthy God. A. Why do you quarrel with me? I, Moses, am not the source of the water. B. Why do you try, literally, test the Lord? After all God has done for you, why do you continue to test him? Verse 3. But the people thirsted there for water, and the people grumbled against Moses and said, "Why did you bring us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and livestock with thirst?" Again, the Israelites seem to attribute miracles, this time the Exodus itself, to Moses. This confusion of Moses with God will loom as a major theme in the Torah. It is ultimately, as I will show, the reason Moses is not allowed to enter the Promised Land. We have here more of the exaggerations and distortions that so often characterize chronic malcontents and complainers. Did these people really believe Moses took them out of Egypt to kill them? Of course not. But when complainers get angry, they often exercise no restraint over their tongues and say whatever mean-spirited thoughts come into their heads. Even the most devout have doubts about God intervening on their behalf. Verse 4. Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, "What shall I do with this people? Before long they will be stoning me." Moses seems to be genuinely afraid of the people. The throwing of rocks has apparently characterized Middle Eastern political protests from time immemorial. Moses, too, may be expressing a lack, or at least a lapse, of trust in God. Does he really think God will allow him to be killed? The point is made not to cast blame on Moses, a true giant among men, but only to illustrate how normal it is for anyone, even Moses, for whom God has already done so much, to have doubts about whether God will again intervene on his behalf. Verse 5. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Pass before the people." In Rashi's view, God is annoyed with Moses for suggesting the Israelites are threatening his life. "Why have you uttered slander against my children?" Rashi imagines God saying. God therefore tells Moses to walk in front of the people, so he will realize they are not going to stone him after all. Verse 5, continued, "Take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take along the rod with which you struck the Nile, and set out." Previously, Moses used this rod to turn the Nile to blood. God wants the people to realize he can do whatever he wants with Moses' rod. Whereas it once functioned to deprive the Egyptians of drinking water by turning the Nile into blood, it will now serve to provide water for the Israelites. Sarna. Verse 6. "I will be standing there before you on the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock, and water will issue from it, and the people will drink." And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. We should relate to God as adults relate to parents, not as children do. Verse 7. The place was named Massah and Meribah, because the Israelites quarreled, and because they tried the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord present among us or not?" The Hebrew words Massah and Meribah mean test and quarrel. The people defined whether or not God was in their presence by whether or not they got what they needed. Like children, the Israelites were only able to trust in God when he was directly and obviously providing for their welfare. That is an understandable view of God for the first generation of monotheists, who, moreover, were led out into the wilderness with no way to supply their own basic needs. But we who live thousands of years later should no longer be like children in our attitudes toward God. We should relate to God as adults. And just as adults can no longer rely on their parents to provide for their every need, religious people should not rely on God to provide for their every need. God provided for all the needs of the people in the desert because the people of Israel were still in their infancy and because they were unable in their circumstances to provide for themselves. According to developmental psychology, we need our parents to take care of us when we are young in order to develop the emotional maturity sufficient to take care of ourselves as adults. Jews and all others who believe in God should do the same. So long as we remember the Exodus and God's caring for the Israelites in the desert, we should develop the emotional and theological maturity not to demand ongoing divine intervention, just as mature adults do not demand this of their parents, and to know God exists and loves us even when we do not perceive or receive direct intervention. There is no other choice. If faith in God and leading a religious life were dependent on constant and obvious divine intervention on our behalf, no one would believe in God. Verse 8. Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. The sudden unprovoked aggression of the nation of Amalek is the fourth crisis to befall the Israelites in their journey from Egypt to Sinai. Verse 9. Moses said to Joshua, "Pick some men for us and go out and do battle with Amalek. Tomorrow I will station myself on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand." Verse 10. Joshua did as Moses told him and fought with Amalek, while Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. Verse 11. Then, whenever Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed. But whenever he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. Verse 12. But Moses' hands grew heavy, so they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it, while Aaron and Hur, one on each side, supported his hands. Thus his hands remained steady until the sun set. Obviously, connecting Israel's fortunes in the battle to whether or not Moses' hands were upraised suggests this can only be explained as yet another divine miracle. A less miraculous interpretation is offered by the Talmud. Did the hands of Moses make or break the course of the war? Rather, the text implies that whenever the Israelites looked up and dedicated their hearts to their Father in heaven, they prevailed, but otherwise they fell. Verse 13. And Joshua overwhelmed the people of Amalek with the sword. Verse 14. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Inscribe this in a document as a reminder, and read it aloud to Joshua. I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven." This verse seems to contain a contradiction. We are supposed to remember the nation of Amalek, yet God will blot out Amalek's memory. Which is it? Perhaps the point is that we are to remember great evil, but ideally the perpetrators of the evil are forgotten. Those who do evil, from the mass murderers in our societies to the monsters of genocide, all want to make a name for themselves. They should not be rewarded in this way. Perhaps that is why the Torah leaves out the name of the Pharaoh who ordered the murder of the Israelite babies, in order to ensure his acts are remembered, but not his name. To this day, when Jews speak of a particularly evil figure, in the modern period generally Hitler, they will often follow the mention of the person's name with the words, "May his name and memory be blotted out." Yimach shimo v'zichrono. As to the reason for this particular animosity against Amalek, see the commentary on Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 17 through 18. Verse 15. And Moses built an altar and named it Adonai Nisi. Nisi means "my ness," which in biblical Hebrew means a banner or a standard. So the name of the altar is YHVH, is my banner. Verse 16. He said it means "hand upon the throne of the Lord. The Lord will be at war with Amalek throughout the ages." Chapter 18. Another non-Jewish hero in the Torah. Verse 1. Jethro, priest of Midian. In order to read through the Torah in its entirety in synagogue each year, Jews long ago divided the Torah into weekly portions. Each portion is named for the first major word appearing in the portion. The first major word in this verse is Jethro, so Jethro is the name of this portion. Jethro is one of three portions in the Torah named for non-Jews, or more precisely non-Israelites. The two others are Noah and Balak. Both Noah and Jethro are outstanding people. Noah was renowned for his righteousness and Jethro for his wisdom. Balak was the villainous king of Moab. The same number of Torah portions are named for Jews: Sarah, Korach, and Pinchas. Sarah is the first matriarch. Korach was a malevolent demagogue, and Pinchas was a zealous defender of the faith, but not one to be emulated. See Commentary on Numbers, chapter 25, verses 6 through 8. This distribution of names underscores yet again, the Torah is not a provincial document concerned only with Jews. Its concern is all humanity, and its primary concern is goodness. That's why it doesn't begin with Jews, but with the creation of the world. So too, although the Jews are the chosen people, they are never accorded special rights. On the contrary, they are held to higher standards than other people and punished accordingly. As the prophet Amos cites God saying to the Jews, "You alone have I singled out of all the families of the earth. That is why I will call you to account for all your iniquities." Amos chapter 3, verse 2. And as noted previously, the Torah often depicts Jews acting badly and non-Jews as moral heroes. In this portion, for instance, Jethro is the hero, even though he is a Midianite, that is, pagan, priest. In keeping with the Torah's universal and moral concerns, the medieval Jewish commentator Radak made a powerful point. The story of Jethro follows right after the story of Amalek, lest any Jew conclude that all non-Jews are enemies of the Jewish people. Similarly, Yad Vashem, the museum in Israel that documents the Holocaust, has an extensive forest of trees planted to honor non-Jews who risked their lives to save Jews during the Holocaust, those known as the righteous among the nations. This grove plays a comparable role to the placement of the Jethro story here, a reminder that even during the Holocaust, not all non-Jewish Europeans were Jew haters. The Torah mentions Jethro as a Midianite priest completely matter-of-factly. He is not only a non-Jew, but a priest who serves what the Torah regards as false gods. But the Torah mentions him without even a hint of opprobrium. What matters is he is a good man. He is Moses' father-in-law, and he does not deny the God of the Jews. He even believes, as we shall see, in the supremacy of God while still serving Midianite gods. Neither the Torah nor later Judaism demand everyone in the world be Jewish. God wants, more than anything, that people be good. And the best way to achieve that end is to have the world believe in God and his moral law, specifically the Ten Commandments or the ancient Talmudic formulation, the seven Noahide laws. Seven basic moral laws the rabbis deduced from Genesis. Noahide refers to the sons of Noah, meaning all humanity. The Torah repeatedly identifies Jethro, a Midianite priest, as Moses' father-in-law. Verse 1. Moses' father-in-law. Importantly, Jethro is always described as Moses' father-in-law. Such a repetition of a person's relationship to another is unique in the Torah. One obvious reason is his significance, at least at this point in the story, emanates from his relationship to Moses. But whatever the reason, it is noteworthy the Torah constantly emphasizes Jethro's familial relationship to Moses. It is noteworthy because later Jewish law, which due to its strong opposition to intermarriage, primarily to prevent an assimilation that could lead to the disappearance of the small Jewish people, would certainly not go out of its way to mention a familial connection between a Jew and a non-Jew related through marriage. Verse 1, continued, heard all that God had done for Moses and for Israel his people, how the Lord had brought Israel out from Egypt. The Hebrew is ambiguous here. It is not clear whether the Israelites are being described as God's people or as Moses' people. The truth is, both would be accurate in this context, but it is uniformly understood in Jewish sources as meaning God's people, hence the capitalized H in the word his. Verse 2. So Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after she had been sent home. Like Jethro, Zipporah is always identified in terms of her relationship to Moses. And she, too, was not born a Jew, though it is generally assumed she converted in some way or another, evidence for which is suggested by her punctiliousness about circumcising their son. This verse suggests Moses had earlier sent his wife and children back to Midian, so his father-in-law could take care of them while Moses was dealing with Pharaoh and leading the Israelites out of Egypt. Moses' considerable responsibilities and consequent absence from his family must have taken a toll on him and his family. Throughout history, great missions undertaken by individuals have often come at the expense of the person's family life. For example, the Torah strongly implies Abraham and his wife Sarah permanently separated after Abraham nearly sacrificed their son Isaac. See comment on Genesis chapter 22, verse 19. And the Torah never makes any reference to what became of Moses' two sons. See commentary to Exodus chapter 6, verse 23. Verse 3. And her two sons, of whom one was named Gershom, that is to say, I have been a stranger in a foreign land. Verse 4, and the other was named Eliezer, meaning, the God of my father was my help, and he delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. Moses' second son's name refers to the time when Pharaoh wanted to kill Moses for killing the Egyptian overseer. See chapter 2, verse 15. Moses fled to Midian, where God protected him from Pharaoh's wrath, chapter 4, verse 19, and where he married Zipporah. Gershom's birth was recorded in Exodus chapter 2, verse 22, while Eliezer is mentioned here for the first time. Verse 5. Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, brought Moses' sons and wife to him in the wilderness, where he was encamped at the mountain of God. This is Sinai, where the Israelites will receive the Ten Commandments. Verse 6. He sent word to Moses, "I, your father-in-law Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her two sons." Jethro refers to Gershom and Eliezer as Zipporah's two sons, rather than as your, Moses's, and Zipporah's two sons. It seems an odd way to describe a man's children. Perhaps in that culture at that time, this was a common way for a father to refer to the children of his daughter, or perhaps Jethro intended to convey some message. We cannot know. Verse 7. Moses went out to meet his father-in-law. He bowed low and kissed him. Each asked after the other's welfare, and they went into the tent. Verse 8. Moses then recounted to his father-in-law everything that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, all the hardships that had befallen them on the way, and how the Lord had delivered them. It must also have been a great pleasure for Moses, as it is for any leader, to have someone with whom he could talk freely and unselfconsciously. Verse 9. And Jethro rejoiced over all the kindness that the Lord had shown Israel when he delivered them from the Egyptians. The origins of the expression Baruch Hashem, blessed be the Lord. Verse 10. Blessed be the Lord, Jethro said. In Hebrew, the words for blessed be the Lord are Baruch Hashem, which to this day remains one of the most commonly used expressions among religious Jews. Religious Jews almost always answer the question, how are you, with Baruch Hashem. The phrase has come to mean God is deserving of blessing regardless of one's situation at any given moment. Few Jews realize, however, it was a Midianite priest who most famously uttered these traditional words of praise for God. In fact, the term Baruch Hashem is said three times in the Torah, and remarkably, always by a non-Jew. By Jethro in this verse, by Noah, Genesis chapter 9, verse 26, and by Abraham's servant, presumably Eliezer, Genesis chapter 24, verse 27. Rabbi J.J. Schachter notes what is also striking is that while people normally use the expression blessed be the Lord to refer to God's treatment of them, Jethro expresses his gratitude to God for God's kind treatment of others, in this case, Moses and the Israelites. On caring about loved ones before strangers. Verse 10 continued. Who delivered you from the Egyptians and from Pharaoh, and who delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians? Jethro's first concern is for his son-in-law. He praises God for saving Moses and then for saving the people. Jethro's statement is a reminder that though it is not appropriate to care only about our loved ones, it is appropriate to care about our loved ones first. Anyone who does not feel the suffering or death of a loved one more acutely than the suffering or death of a stranger is not emotionally normal. But anyone who feels nothing about the suffering or death of strangers is not a mensch, that is not a good person. Not by might. God is not God because he wins battles. Verse 11. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods. Jethro believes in God because of God's show of force against Egypt. His theology would seem to square with the prevailing attitude at that time. Gods, like nature, are governed by the law of survival of the fittest. Whichever God proves strongest is the God that commands belief, or at least the most belief. The Bible, in contrast, holds that God is not God because he wins battles, but because of his superior morality and the power of his spirit. As the Hebrew prophet famously expressed it, "Not by might and not by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord." Zechariah chapter 4, verse 6. Thus, many centuries later, when the temple in Jerusalem was destroyed and the Jews taken into captivity and dispersed by the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar, The Jews did not presume the Babylonian gods were stronger than the God of Israel, but that the God of Israel sent Nebuchadnezzar to punish the Israelites for their sinfulness. The Jewish belief, rooted in the Torah, was that God was God whether the Jews won or lost any given war. That is a major reason Judaism survived, while all the other religions of antiquity, whose adherents, unlike Jews, adopted the religion of their conquerors, did not. Verse 11 continued, "Yes, by the result of their very schemes against